Linnea's empathy for other kids is clear, but not at all unusual, according to Allison Gopnik. Gopnik's a UC Berkeley psychologist whose work digs at the roots of empathy, belief, and thinking in children as young as 14 months. She tells Steve Paulson that even the experts underestimate children.
For generations, people, including, you know, people like Piaget, the great founder of cognitive development, thought that children were irrational and egocentric and amoral and restricted to the here and now. And really, in the last 15 or 20 years, we've completely turned that picture on its head. And even the very youngest children turn out to both know more and learn more than we ever would have thought before.
So this is really interesting. I mean, you're really saying that tiny babies are not just these blank blobs that kind of do nothing. I mean, there is stuff going on in their minds.
Absolutely. And not only is there stuff going on in their minds, but we think increasingly that the stuff going on in their minds, far from being this kind of irrational mush that people thought before, the word that people sometimes use is a sponge, this kind of undifferentiated sponge soaking up everything that goes on. In fact, we think that even infants and certainly preschoolers are using some of the same methods of learning that the very smartest scientists use. So my first book was called The Scientist in the Crib. And the idea is that even babies and young children are developing intuitive theories about what's going on around them and then looking at the evidence for and against the theories and changing them just the way that scientists do.
Can you give me an example of this, how this might play out for an 18-month-old baby?
Yeah. Well, here's one that we've actually been looking at. So one of the things that we discovered back in the 90s is that between 15 and 18 months, babies seem to learn about how people's minds work and, in particular, what people want. So, for example, we did an experiment with raw broccoli and goldfish crackers, and the baby sees the experimenter take a little food from each bowl, and the experimenter either smiles and says, crackers, or acts disgusted and says, oh, yuck, crackers. And then she puts out her hand to the baby and says, can you give me some? And the question is, will the baby give her the crackers, which is what the baby likes, or when she likes the broccoli instead of the crackers, will the babies give her the broccoli instead of the crackers? And the story is that 18-month-olds do and 15-month-olds don't. But two things are really striking about this. One is that the 18-month-olds are both not egocentric and also altruistic. They recognize that other people want something different than they do, and they try to get them what they want, which is actually a pretty hard thing even for grown-ups sometimes. The other thing, of course, is that the 15-month-olds recognize that something strange is going on, but they still just seem to think that everyone will want the same thing. So what we've been doing now is actually taking 15-month-olds and giving them examples, having people come into the lab who want different things. One person picks up a teddy bear, or another person picks up a frog, and so forth. So we actually show the babies evidence about what people want. And what we've discovered is that if you give the 15-month-olds that kind of evidence, then they're more likely to adopt the hypothesis that the person wants something different. So these very young babies in our lab and in lots of other experiments seem to be doing a central thing that scientists do, which is taking statistics and using statistical patterns to figure out how the world works, to figure out the rules, the orderliness, the laws of the universe. And even 7 or 8 month old babies seem to be doing that.
Well, this is also a profound idea that you're getting at. I mean, you're really suggesting that the roots of morality go way back, I mean, to when we're babies. I mean, it's not necessarily something that we reason out once we become adolescents or adults.
Yeah. So again, the Piaget and Lawrence Kohlberg, who was the Piagetian who first wrote about moral development, thought that we didn't really understand about morality until we were adults. And he thought that some people never got there. And in fact, the new data suggests that even babies have at least some elements like I think the golden rule, the idea that you should do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Now, of course, there's more to morality than that. So I think it's important to say that babies also seem to have the ability to revise what they think about the world, including revising what they think about morality. So they, by the time they're 2, they seem to understand the difference, for instance, between general moral principles, like not hitting anybody, and things that are just social conventions, like not dropping your clothes on the floor. And even 2.5-year-olds will say that you can never hit anybody. Even if everybody else said that it was okay, you couldn't do it. But if they changed the rules about dropping your clothes on the floor, then it would be okay to drop your clothes on the floor. So these even more sophisticated aspects of morality seem to be things that children are developing as they go through the world, as they interact with other people, as they think more profoundly about what other people are like.
Now, there's another thing that you have spent a lot of time looking at, and that is the importance of play and imagination and imaginary friends. So why are you so interested in these things?
Well, again, thinking about the idea of the letting the children teach us what's important to them. Anybody who's spent any time with 3- and 4-year-olds know that one of the things that's most striking and impressive about them is the fact that they spend so much time off in these kind of crazy imaginary worlds. You know, they're off in this universe of princesses and ninjas and tea parties. And that just happens very spontaneously when they're about 18 months old. Now, for a psychologist, that should be a clue. Something important is going on. They wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't serving some kind of function. But for a long time, it was very mysterious about if you really wanted to learn about the world, why would you spend so much time thinking about worlds that don't really exist?
So you're saying that, children are naturally curious about counterfactual worlds, worlds that don't actually exist, and they sort of want to play out the possibilities.
Exactly. And one of the great things about human beings is that that ability to think counterfactually, to say, what would the world be like if it were different, also means that you can actually go out and make the world different and see what the consequences of that are.
So all those hours that some kids spend playing with their imaginary friends or creating imaginary worlds, there's a payoff there. Somehow they are, better equipped to create these counterfactual scenarios.
That's the hypothesis. That's the idea, that what they're doing when they're imagining is they're exploring possibilities, exploring ideas, exploring all the ways the world could be. And, of course, that's what we as adults do when we read fiction or when we write plays or when we do science.
Is there a takeaway for either parents or teachers about this? I mean, if we think, for instance, that cultivating the imaginative capacities of children is a good thing? Is there something that we should do to help foster that?
Well, I think one of the practical things that we're facing right now is that the very fact that the scientists have discovered that young children are learning so much, which is great, has had a kind of boomerang effect, which is that people think, well, we need to have early childhood education, which is absolutely true, and it should look like school. It should look like what we do with 6- or 7-year-olds where we're actually telling them things. And the result has been that preschool teachers, who I think intuitively know all and have known all along that children are learning through exploration and play, often feel like they're kind of stuck in a pincer movement between parents who are ambitious for their children to do well in school later on and policymakers who, you know, want to have some bang for their buck if they invest in early childhood. And both those groups, I think, are kind of squeezing out the spontaneous play and imagination and pretend that children do in favor of doing things like having reading drills or math drills or things that you can do a better job of measuring on a standardized test. And I think from a scientific perspective, that's really unfortunate. We don't know yet exactly what pretend and play do for children, but it's a very good bet that they're doing something and doing something that's more profound than any of the things that we could imagine teaching the children. And again, I think the moral is to let the children tell us what they're learning rather than thinking that we know what they ought to learn.
Alison Gopnik is a professor of psychology and philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley. She's the author of The Scientist in the Crib. She spoke with Steve Paulson.